Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Thank you so much for joining us. And remember that you can find us on Facebook. You can also email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. This evening, our guest is Alicia Surrett, and she is the CEO and the founder of Pentegrion Capital. In just a moment, Alicia will be back, and she'll tell us all about what she's up to. This is Heartstock. Thanks for listening. But on the other side, it didn't say
nothing. That time was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to New York Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. This land was made for you and me.
This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Our guest this evening is Alicia Surrett, and she is the CEO and founder of Pentegrion Capital. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm really well. Thank you so much. Thank you for being our guest. Can you just introduce yourself a little bit to our listeners and tell them who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on the show, and a hi to all of your listeners. My name is Alicia Surrett, and I, as you mentioned, I'm the founder and CEO of Pentegrion Capital. And Pentegrion is basically a vehicle for my own angel investment. So I'm investing in startups across industries in the very earliest stages. And I've been doing that for 7 or 8 years now. And in addition, I do a lot of work in the entrepreneurial world broadly. I have been an Inc. contributor, so I put out articles about what I've learned along the way. I've taught entrepreneurs at Columbia University. I've been on TV, CNBC, MSNBC 100 plus times, giving feedback to entrepreneurs on their pitches. And as you know, I also founded a whole initiative called Point 25 to help women-led companies build robust advisory boards. So I'm out and about in the entrepreneurial world, not only investing, but doing a bunch of other things. And I often sit on the boards and advisory boards of my portfolio companies and just really get involved. So I'm kind of all entrepreneurs all the time. That's my daily routine.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a ton of fun.
So with your company, Pentegrion Capital, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about what motivated you to become an angel investor, and especially why startups in the early stage?
Sure. So my background had been mostly in the financial industry. I had kind of done the traditional track of going into banking, and then I worked at some large investment firms along the way. But what really tipped me off into the entrepreneurial world is that before founding Pentegrion, I had been an entrepreneur myself. So I was the first employee and CAO of what we grew into a multi-billion dollar private equity firm. And that sounds like this kind of big, glamorous endeavor. But the truth was, is it was a small group of us starting a company for the first time. And as the first employee, I was doing anything and everything to get the company up and running. Everything from, you know, payroll to insurance for the company and benefits for the employees and setting up retirement platforms and dealing with vendors and hiring people and setting up global offices and, you know, creating employee handbooks and creating websites and compliance and all of these other things. And what I found was that it was amazing. It was like drinking from a fire hose and exhausting. But once the firm became steady state, I missed that entrepreneurial vibe. And that was what prompted me to basically stay in the entrepreneurial world and create a vehicle where I could invest in companies and really help them through everything that I'd learned, but maybe not have the crazy lifestyle that I used to. So that's kind of how I got to where I got now. And it was kind of the thrill of being an entrepreneur and then wanting to stay close to the world from here on out.
What was your background as far as your upbringing? Where did you grow up? And did you always see yourself in this business entrepreneurial world?
No, not at all, actually. I grew up in South Carolina. And I don't know how many people know that, but I grew up kind of in smaller towns outside of the two recognizable cities, Columbia and Charleston. So I often just say, you know, I'm from Charleston, and people seem to recognize that. But I didn't grow up knowing anything about finance. It wasn't until I went up north to school. I went to Wharton undergrad, and that was kind of like this big eye-opener of like what this world was all about. And so growing up, I kind of generally knew I wanted to be in business. I was really proficient in math, and I was really passionate about that. But I just didn't really think I wanted to be an engineer. So I think it was really just a lot of smaller steps along the way, where the more I learned about the industries out there, the more I would kind of throw myself into something and then just would like take a step closer to what seemed more exciting. And you know, 20 plus years later, I'm kind of where I am now. But I had no sense of what that ultimate goal would be. And I could also tell you I have no sense of where I would be 20 years from now. So I just, you know, I'm kind of learning as I go and just making decisions based on, you know, what seems interesting and where I can learn and what seems exciting.
So I'd kind of like to approach this from the investor's standpoint to start with, as opposed to the entrepreneurs or the founder of the startup that is seeking capital. From an investor's standpoint, why did you choose this particular niche as opposed to, you know, later stage startups or companies?
Well, I had been exposed to so many different asset classes prior to doing this, right? So I had been in the hedge fund world, I'd been in the private equity world. And what I really felt like set this area, angel investing, apart from those other areas was that in the early stages, you really are betting on the person. You are betting on the entrepreneur. And that's really exciting. So you're looking at numbers, yes, but you're really thinking about how persistent is this person? Is this person dynamic? Are they going to have other people that like buy into their vision? And that is just, there's something that's just like so awesome about that. And it's interesting too, from an investor's perspective, because if you are the type of investor that rolls up your sleeves and really helps the entrepreneurs, the type of difference that you can make in a startup company is immense. You know, it could be like a crucial introduction or two to new clients. It could be helping them raise a fundraising round. It could be introducing them to the press. That kind of difference in an early stage company is so big compared to a different, you know, the difference you could make in a Fortune 500 company. So I think it was really that closeness to the entrepreneur, the excitement around being part of their mission and really helping them and kind of changing the trajectory and the valuation of a company through your own acts. Like that was what really excited me.
Mm-hmm. And from an investor's standpoint, how do you choose winners? Are there, you know, you mentioned a dynamic personality, somebody that's really has a lot of stick-to-itiveness. Are there any other characteristics that you look for as an investor for your companies that you put money into?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two big areas, and one you've already mentioned, and that's what we've talked about, is really the person that you're betting on. And then the other is the classic diligence that you go through in analyzing any company, right? Like, do you clearly understand what they do? Do you understand their competitive advantage? What are their milestones to date? And do they seem like they're going in a great direction? Do they have a articulated sales and marketing strategy? Do you like their team? Do you think that they've built a lot of great people around them? Have they created a great advisory board? You know, do you understand their financials and what they're asking for money-wise and what they'd use the money for and who's their customer and how are they pricing their product and what are the margins and, you know, what are the distribution relationships and partnerships? All of these things that I mentioned, and there's tons more, but you could dig into with the entrepreneur for, you know, 1 to 2 hours in each subject. But I think it's really the developing of the relationship as you ask questions and getting that feeling like, yes, this person knows what they're doing. I want to be part of this with them. I really believe in them, right? So I think that the diligence questions really help you decide about betting on the person. but I think it's really those two processes that kind of run in tandem, where you decide after learning a lot and really getting to know the person, like, do I want to make this investment and be tied to this person for years and years on their journey?
So do you recommend that investors really put their money into companies that they feel they can help and that they have a working knowledge of that industry?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think it really depends on the person. I think some investors don't want to be active investors, and that's totally fine, right? There's a lot of entrepreneurs out there that would be more than happy to take money from a passive investor, and that would help them along the way. I personally am more on the active front because I really do feel like the more you help a company, the more you can help increase your valuation in that company. And it's also pretty fulfilling. So I think that investors could do something completely outside of their knowledge area, and that could be fulfilling to them. And maybe learning is one of the motivators, or investors could be primarily motivated by making money and they want to stick to the industry they know. I think it really just depends on what the goals are of the person and, you know, how much time they have to get involved and what they're really trying to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned value a few times, and increasing the value of the company is very rewarding. How do you come to an agreement on the value before you invest? And the numbers are just, quite honestly, I find them mind-boggling sometimes. Mm-hmm. Millions of dollars for a company that has no real revenue to date sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, you're right to be a little frustrated in seeing these numbers, because it's not just the science. There's the combination of it being part art and part science. And so I think that the science part of it is all the things that I mentioned earlier, the diligence items, right? Is how can you put valuations around intellectual property and how valuable the team is and all of these things, right? I mean, roughly you can kind of see on a relative basis a startup that maybe has, you know, more going for it than another, but the art of it is also your own knowledge as an investor, right? And in no particular order of preference, it could be your knowledge of where we are in the investment cycle. You know, are companies commanding a higher valuation than a few years before? Is the market a little frothy with more premiums? What's your knowledge of other comparable companies in the industry? You know, what valuations have they had? How is this current company faring relative to some of these other companies? What's the demand for this company? Are there tons of investors who want to put money in it? If so, that drives up the price. So there's all of these different components into it, you know, that go into it. Or, you know, is this person a serial entrepreneur, and are you just going to bet on them because of their past experience? You just assume they know what they're doing. You know, you can't really quantify a lot of those things. And so I think that's frustrating, because at the end of the day, it's like many things in finance where it's supply and demand. And the more demand for a company, the higher valuation they can claim. But I think, you know, if you start with a lot of the business fundamentals and you start with comparable company valuation, you can usually approximate, you know, where the company might be valuation-wise.
Mm-hmm. We're at that halfway point, and we're going to take a quick music break. In just a moment, we will be right back with Alicia and more questions about angel investing. This is Heartstock, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. We'll be right back. Hello, you're listening to Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy, your host. Thank you so much for listening. Our guest today is Alicia Surratt, and she is the CEO and founder of Pentagrion. Hi again, Alicia.
Hi.
So we were just talking about angel investing, and for all those existing angel investors and those anticipating, what good advice do you have?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I stress from the very start is for people who are just starting out in angel investing, you really do need to build a diverse portfolio. And by that, I mean, it can't just be, you know, one or two investments here or there. In order to get what the asset class is proposed to have, that is 25% returns over time, you should build a portfolio of 20 plus companies, probably over a 10-year time frame. And the reason for that is because in the angel investment class, one out of 10 companies are probably going to be like the home runs in the portfolio, and half are probably going to go under or lose money. So you really have to build the diverse portfolio with 20 plus companies. And as you're building that portfolio, you know, pace yourself over time. Co-invest with people who have done this before. Don't jump into the first investment. You probably will see 100 deals before you want to pick the one that you want to go with in each scenario. And when you do invest, don't pester the companies, you know, let them run the company, but be helpful. The other big things that I would say is, you know, make sure that you're doing the diligence in the companies before investing, 20 plus hours probably per company, and help being helpful after you make the investment. If you don't have time to do those things, you can always be a passive investor or maybe join an angel network and go into one of their funds. The other couple of final points I would make are, do some reading beforehand. There are some great books out there. Intro to Angel Financing by Susan Preston. Winning Angels is another one. And also think about your profile before you start investing. You know, how much do you want to invest per deal? Do you have industry preferences? Do you have geographic preferences? Do you have valuation preferences? You know, all of these things are important, not only to know for yourself, but to communicate to entrepreneurs to really help them assess the fit with you. So those are probably the big things that I would stress to be a successful angel investor.
You mentioned earlier that Pentagrion is primarily your angel investing firm. Do you have co-investors as well?
I do. So oftentimes I will lead a deal, and in that case, I will have other investors co-invest with me or piggyback on my investments. But that really is kind of at my discretion. And it just really depends on the deal and how much room there might be in the round. So that certainly happened on a number of occasions. And it really just, you know, it depends on the investment.
And how do you month to month, year to year, deal with the ups and downs? As you mentioned, there's a lot of failure.
Mm-hmm. Well, to some extent, there's not much you can do about it other than be helpful to the companies, because it is something that that's just the way it is in this asset class. And unlike the stock market, if something is going bad, you really can't sell out of these companies. So I think you just have to resolve yourself to be helpful and to let things play out. And that's really it. There's nothing more you can do. And I almost like that, because I feel like when you're dealing with the stock market, you know, there's the temptation to sell or get back in or anything like that. It almost like takes that option away from you. And so you just buckle down and be helpful and, you know, let the cards play out as they will.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it's a gamble, an educated gamble? I mean, a lot of people say that even about the stock market. So I guess it's a question of, you know, how comfortable you are with that level of risk.
Gambling, I don't know if I would necessarily say that, but I do agree with you that it's a high risk, high return asset class. And these investments are highly illiquid and you can be tied to them for 10 plus years. And so I think that you definitely want to do your diligence. You definitely want to do your homework. You definitely want to be helpful. But that's just the way that it works, is that some of these companies are going to go out of business. And that's the nature of startups.
Mm-hmm. And how about from the startup perspective? You've been pitched by literally hundreds of startups.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
so
sure
advice for them.
Yeah. What is your advice, and how can startups not shoot themselves in the foot from the get-go by, you know, making fundamental mistakes?
Yes. Okay. So this is a great question. And I will say within the last year, I actually did a TED talk on all the reasons why investors say no. And I think like when I last checked, it had over 85,000 views. So if you want like a, you know, kind of a 9-minute summary that took me 100 hours to prepare for, like that's out there. But let me kind of give you the broad overview is that the big pieces of advice I give to entrepreneurs are kind of on both the do's and don'ts side is, you know, first for entrepreneurs, definitely put yourself out there, whether it's, you know, applying for competitions or putting yourself out there in contests. Studies have shown that the more you do that, the higher your probability of receiving funding is. And so that's something that's, you know, just great for personal growth, but also great for funding prospects. Building a great advisory board is a really beneficial thing for startups because oftentimes investors gain confidence that the entrepreneur knows how to fill the voids in their company and attract talent to help them along the way. I also tell entrepreneurs to really research investors before they contact them, you know, just making sure that the person you're targeting invests in your industry and they invest in your geography and, you know, the check sizes they write or the valuations they target are consistent with your company. They should also contact their alumni base, no matter where they went to school. I guarantee you, their school would love to say that they are an example of an successful entrepreneur. And so contacting the school, seeing how they could be helpful, introductions they could make. I also tell entrepreneurs to start local if they're raising money. So a lot of times entrepreneurs spend, you know, a ton of time trying to target people in Silicon Valley where maybe it makes sense just to kind of start with the local angel networks and then move on from there. They have to educate themselves. So, you know, just before they ever go out and fundraise or talk to investors, know what their own proposed valuation is and know how the terms in these deals work. What else? I mean, I would say don't cold email people. You know, you have to try for the warm introductions. If you're going back and forth with investors, you can't be slow in responding to their requests. And always keep in mind that you're building relationships with people. So not acting too salesy, not proposing to use their money to pay yourself a high salary or to you know, get out of some legal spat that you've gotten into or pay down your debt or, you know, pestering them during the holidays. All of these things are just kind of big no-nos generally, but you know, it's a relationship. And then finally, I would say really entrepreneurs should put themselves out there and being thought leaders too. If you're a knowledgeable person in your industry, maybe those are LinkedIn posts that you have or contributor posts that you can share. But I think those go a long way in terms of establishing your presence and your knowledge in an industry and giving investors confidence and wanting to bet on you.
Those are all really good points. And speaking of points, 0.25 is also your baby. Share with our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, first, compliments on such a great segue. But, yeah, so 0.25 was something I founded a couple of years ago, and it's named 0.25 after the 0.25% of equity that an advisor often gets when they join a startup's advisory board. And I founded this initiative to help women-led startups in particular build robust advisory boards, because what I saw from a fundraising perspective was a lot of these early stage startups that were led by women were dealing with biases out there. And they were pitching to often majority male audiences that maybe didn't get what they were doing or were skeptical from the start. But when they had a great advisory board of C-level people, people who were helpful to them, oftentimes it was so much harder for that investor to say no. Like they wanted to learn more. And I thought, well, this is a way I could really be helpful to these women because they aren't paying cash out of pocket to form these advisory boards. So I started this series where I looked through my own Rolodex and looked at people I knew who were kind of C-level people who I thought would be great advisors and be helpful to women entrepreneurs. And I basically, you know, profiled them. And then I had the women entrepreneurs from all over the country, as you know, because you attended one of the events, like, you know, apply. And I picked out, you know, the best women I could find. And so the series happens over the course of 2 weeks, it's four different nights. And on each night, I profile four potential advisors and I have about 12 women CEOs attend. And the idea is that, you know, it's kind of like warm intros at scale, is that the women entrepreneurs get to meet, you know, four C-level people. Maybe they click with them, maybe they don't, but these are certainly amazing contacts. The women entrepreneurs get to meet each other, you know, so very often they're not walking into a room where it's like 11 other phenomenal CEOs like themselves, where they could have a great peer group. And the C-level advisors are giving advice and they're trying to be helpful. And so it's been something that has been just personally fulfilling to me. I meet about 50 women CEOs each time I run the series. I've wound up investing in a couple along the way too. But it's really, it's partly a way for me to be helpful to the community of giving these women introductions to the potential advisors and to other phenomenal women CEOs, and, you know, really creating that old girls network that can be so helpful on this like really tough journey that everybody goes through as an entrepreneur.
And do you have partners that you work with at 325?
Well, I don't really have partners. The events are always sponsored by Lynn Loacker at Davis Wright and Tremaine. So she's so wonderful about offering us the space to hold the events and providing some wine and some cheese, which is awesome. And I love her because she's just so supportive of the whole community. But it's something that I really like doing personally, because I like reviewing all of the applications personally and handpicking the advisors and really walking them through the process. So it's kind of my baby in that sense. I don't necessarily want to, you know, give that away, because it's so wonderful for me to meet everyone and to really get to know them during the process.
And you've mentioned that you found some companies that you've invested in. And I'm just wondering, you know, do you have favorite sectors, you know, areas that you feel most comfortable putting your money into?
Yes, I do. I mean, the one area I don't really touch is life sciences. So anything having to do with clinical trials or FDA approval, it's just really not my background. And then alternatively, I have done a lot of investing in consumer companies, because I do love investing in women. And I found, at least in this generation, so many women have started consumer companies because they have been solving immediate personal pain points. And so even though my background was in the financial world, I've really loved getting up to speed in the consumer world, products and services, just to support women. So that's an area where I've definitely done a lot of investing and didn't expect to, but really love being involved there because of the entrepreneurs.
We've come to the end of our time allotment, which is always kind of a sad point. But at any rate, how might folks find you?
Well, I'm pretty active on social media. So my Twitter account is really active. It's just my name, at Alicia Surrett. I post things on LinkedIn all the time. I have a YouTube channel, so all of the appearances on TV are up there if entrepreneurs want to see sample pitches, that kind of thing. And I have a website where I put up all the writing that I've done for Inc. It's pantagrion.com, if that's helpful to anyone. But you know, I'm pretty active, and so I think you can find a lot of content in any one of those areas.
Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for being on Heartstock Radio. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Heartstock. I'm Carol Murphy, your host. And we've been speaking with Alicia Surrett. And thank you so much. We'll see you next week. Peace.
And on the sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5, Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via livestream at butteamericaradio.org.